It's hard to think of anything as necessary, enjoyable, and thoroughly human as conversation. Of course, all that aimless talk over the years comes with its pitfalls. We have to endure bores, absorb insults, and learn how to excuse ourselves from awkward situations. And unless you're a gifted gabber like Socrates, conversation requires some work. And this hour will help you find your way to greener conversational pastures. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'd love to get you in on our topic this morning. Have modern Americans lost the knack of good conversation? And how do you define a great talk with someone? Call us up at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. You can also ask our guests for advice on conversational conundrums. And Daniel Menaker, so glad you could join us this hour.
I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, can you tell us, what do we know about where human conversation began?
Well, most anthropologists seem to agree that they began in grooming rituals among our ancestors, primates who gathered together to look, to comb each other's hair, so to speak, but that was the beginning of social bonding and group connections. And when we developed the capacity for language, that sort of social knitting together of groups and clans and tribes expressed itself in the development of conversation.
So you're saying that conversation is basically like picking nits out of each other's hair?
Well, you said it. actually, I tried very hard to avoid that. But it is. I mean, in fact, chimps to this day and many, many other species that are related to us continue to exhibit this behavior. It's not always that they're sort of lousy with lice. They can be very, very clean, and that's what's interesting. In fact, in animals that are totally, clean and clear, they still do grooming rituals because it is part of a social activity.
So it's not so much the necessary passing on of information. It's about bonding.
Well, I think it depends on how you define the word conversation. Clearly, giving someone else a recipe or instructions on how to get there from here, all those things require words. But if you adopt the sort of definition of conversation that I like to work with, which is that it does not involve anything immediately practical or useful, then the answer to your question is no, those are not conversations.
Well, how do you define conversation then?
I think of conversation as being an exchange of thoughts and ideas and reflections and storytelling and sometimes confessional material that passes between two people or among more people for the sake of social bonding rather than for the sake of some absolute purpose or goal, like buying a business or getting an A in a class or learning how to sand, how to use a sander.
So what you're describing, it's sort of more like a jazz riff that two people create together.
That's very good. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I think it is largely improvised and can go off in different directions, but very much like a jazz performance, may have a common thread or two at its heart.
Well, you, as I gather from all the anecdotes in your book, are quite the conversationalist. You enjoy talking, and you've had some time to think about what makes a great conversation, and you've come up with three criteria that you find the most compelling. What are they?
Well, the two obvious ones that most people, I think, would come to, either have already come to or would come to after a moment's thought, are curiosity. If you're not curious about other people, it's going to be very hard to, or curious about yourself or the world, it's going to be very hard to have what I think of as a conversation. The second is humor. That's perhaps just a shade less obvious, but just barely in the shade, almost in the sun, because if you're not at all playful, if you don't see the humor in various situations, you're going to be a very serious and solemn conversationalist, and that's not going to go go over well. The third one is the least obvious, and I call it impudence, for lack of a better word. What I mean is that sometimes in a conversation you have to, I think it helps to get a conversation to be more informal and playful if you can exhibit a little bit of nerve, if you can make gentle fun of somebody or of yourself, so that they know they're not in a meeting at the UN, but in, you know, at a bar having having a talk and a beer.
Can you give us an example of impudence in play?
Well, I would say that your former statement accusing me correctly of saying that conversation started with picking nits from each other is an example of a little bit of a jab, not at me, but just a kind of playfulness that, for me anyway, let me know a little bit about who you are and how you talk. So there's a very current and present example. I know with my daughter often, who's 23, she will, if I repeat myself, she'll say something like, yeah, I never heard that before. I mean, it is a little bit sarcastic, but it's also said with affection, and so that's what I mean. It's sort of like bringing people down to earth. You know, when people court each other in courtship and dating, there's a good deal of teasing that goes on, and I think that's not just for the fun of it. I mean, of course it's fun if you can take it, but it's also to see how resilient the other person is. Somebody takes himself too seriously or more seriously than you like, it's not likely you're going to end up having a good relationship with that person. So I think it's like a testing, like kicking the tires a little bit.
I wonder if you think that we'll remember our really great conversations, kind of the way we remember good vacations. They stick in our mind. Do you remember yours?
I do remember quite a few. I remember one with a teacher I had in college at the end of the exam period once. In particular, I remember another one that I had with an editor who taught me a great deal when I was at The New Yorker. There are ones that stick in my mind, but, you know, I'd almost emphasize that the lack of memory of some good conversations is not a bad thing. I mean, they are, by definition, temporary and evanescent, and that's one of the joys of them. Of course, what you're going to remember is that you like the person that you had a good conversation with, or you'd like to speak to them again. But if it's aimless, if there's no agenda, they can disappear. I mean, that's fine. But what lingers is the sense of connection.
Right. It's sort of like walking away from a delicious meal. You might not remember every bite that you had, but you just sort of have this feeling of well-being.
It's true. In fact, you know, it raises such an interesting question for me and something that's not in the book. I remember when in the 60s, instant replays in sports events started coming on television, you could see the same thing over and over again. I remember a particular catch in a World Series very early on, and they kept showing it on the news and on the during the game itself, and I thought, you know, this is losing some of its magic because it's replayed over and over again. Sometimes the very ephemeralness of something can be one of its joys. It's what good memories are made of, even as you say, even if they're not specific.
Well, in the first chapter of your book, you take a look at some great conversationalists throughout history, and of course Socrates looms large. What is it about him? Why was he such a good chatter?
Well, I think really, he wasn't. I mean, he's famous for his dialogues and for his questioning of conventional wisdom in Athens. But what does make him a good conversationalist isn't so much these sort of almost cross-examinations that he did. It's that he listened so carefully to the replies. And whatever he heard, he evidently thought about, and it led him to another direction. Now, he had reasons and a kind of goal in mind to, for instance, to try to show his fellow citizens where their self-contradictions lay. But what he did do was listen carefully and respond exactly to what was said to him. So you can learn a lot about listening from reading Socrates.
Right. His listening skills seem to be incredibly acute. On the other hand, as you say, it seems like it could be frustrating talking with Socrates because no matter what you say, he had a rejoinder.
That's true. And not only that, but I'm sure we've all met people who, with whom we thought we might be just talking, but it turns into a sort of, well, you of all people should know, and as should I, as a journalist, sometimes you feel like you're being interviewed or sometimes even interrogated. And that's, in a way, what Socrates was doing. And that's why I wouldn't put him at the very top of the list.
Well, who would you put at the top of the list?
Well, by reputation, the people that I talk about in the book are Diderot, the Frenchman of the Enlightenment, David Hume, the Scottish philosopher. Samuel Johnson is somebody that we hear a lot about. But he also had his agenda, so I'm not so sure about him. I think most of us have people that we know we like to talk to, and I think those are the important ones. In my case, there was a writer at The New Yorker who was, in my opinion, the best conversationalist I've ever known.
Really?
His name was Brendan Gill. He died not too long ago. He wrote the theater column for The New Yorker, but he was not only a knowledgeable and funny and somewhat impudent man, but again, he listened so carefully. And sometimes he listened more carefully to you than you listened to yourself. And he would pick up on things and sort of very gently and not intrusively ask you to go on. I remember once he said to me, "There's nothing more interesting than an unfinished sentence." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Usually when someone doesn't finish a sentence, it means there's something interesting at the end of it." And he would do that. If you sort of didn't get to the end of something, he would say, "What were you about to say?" It's almost like a therapist, only there was no, you know, there was no darkness involved. It was always just interesting.
Mm-hmm. That sounds a little bit like what you talk about in your book, A Good Talk, about the idea of dropping a handkerchief in a conversation and having someone pick it up.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been thinking about that book and my book and what I meant, what I said, and what I would have said had I to do it over again, and maybe for the paperback I will. But one way I didn't put it was what I call rewinding. If you're talking to somebody and something comes up that is of interest to you, but you don't quite catch it, or you're rushing forward sort of pell-mell, it's always, first of all, for your own sake, if you're curious, good for you, and it's also a sign of interest to the other person if you say, "Wait a minute, let's go back to what we were just talking about, or let's go back to what you said about planting tulip bulbs too early, or, you know, in that agricultural, or whatever it might be." If you rewind out of your own interest, it's a wonderful way to say, "I'm listening. I want to know more about what we were just talking about." So I think that's what I meant by dropped handkerchiefs, that sometimes in the rush of a conversation, we can let something go by that sort of piqued our imagination for about a second and then passed by. If we can retain that and go back to it, sometimes that's where the most interesting things are.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because there are times when I've been in conversation with someone and something will come up and we'll have to move forward because that's the way the conversation goes. And I never know if it's sort of interrupting the flow of something that's organic to go back and try to stitch it back in.
Well, I think by definition, a good conversation, even with such an interruption or a rewinding, is organic. You'll just change the shape slightly. You know, a new branch will come out. It's just perfectly organic, a new blossom. But you did mention interrupting, and that's another idea I have in the book, which is that most people find that interrupting, or think that interrupting, is rude. And often it is, perhaps most of the time it is, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it shows enthusiasm and engagement, so it's not necessarily just a sin.
One of the other topics that comes up in your book, and I gather lots of people were especially interested in this as you wrote it, is how to deal with bores, people who blather on and on. You had a guy in your book that you talk about who said even the ring on the phone when he called up was boring. And I think everybody knows somebody like that. What do you do when you're stuck with a boar?
Well, unplug the phone if you think he might call. So, no, you know what? First of all, I'm very flattered by the fact that you read the book so carefully, and that's a real compliment. I appreciate it.
Oh, it was a great book. Stayed up too late reading, but it was a very good read.
It's funny because in some interviews I've had about the book, this is probably the question that comes up most often, and I sort of make believe that I have answers in the book, and I don't really. I won't say I was lying, but it's really tough. It's easy if you can get away. It's harder if you, let's say, are at dinner, and maybe a somewhat formal one, as most of us don't go to anymore, which is a good and a bad thing. If you are seated next to someone with whom you clearly have to speak, and if they are boring to you, and you try various techniques of asking them about their life story. I mean, one thing you can always do is say, tell me about yourself. And if you're the kind of person who has curiosity, you will find something of interest in the ensuing 10 or 15 minutes. Even if the person is by nature dull, at least they're different, they're new, they're not you. So there's that kind of automatic interest. But after that, you know, it's like a jail sentence, and you just have to do your time.
And one of the things you suggest, besides that, is top 10 lists. What do? You just say, what are your top 10 movies?
Well, no, I think that's a little abrupt, although sometimes under desperate situations, I've been known after, you know, maybe almost nodding off, just popping up with a question like that. I think one thing you can do, I mean, a conversation is natural, and if you're aware of the way you're manipulating it, it's not really a conversation because it's sort of conscious, self-conscious. But if you're in a situation, if you're in a circumstance that is really dull or where you feel, you know, kind of trapped, you can navigate and manipulate a conversation into a subject that you're interested in yourself. And, for instance, if it's movies, you can say, I don't know, you can say, you know, I'm really tired last night. I went to a 10 o'clock show of The Hurt Locker and didn't get home till midnight. And then, you know, if they don't take the bait, you can sort of weasel your way over into movies. Movies are a topic of tremendous interest for those who like them because they have very visceral impact. People have very strong opinions about them. But top tens in general are a good idea. As I say in the book, they sound vulgar. I mean, like, what's your top 10 foods? It's a little weird just to kind of come out with that. But people do get engaged with those things because they begin to think about themselves and what they like and what they don't like. So you can argue about strawberries, or you can argue about Ingmar Bergman's Wild Strawberries if you're talking about movies.
Well, we need to take a quick break right now and take a pause in our conversation. We'll come back and keep talking with Daniel Menaker, author of A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. He's the author of two books of short stories and the novel The Treatment. His work has also appeared in The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate. And we'd love to hear from you this morning. Do you think modern Americans have lost the knack of good conversation? And how would you define a really great talk with someone? You can call us up at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you this Monday morning as we talk with Daniel Menaker, author of A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. His work has appeared in The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate. And we have an email here from Gina that says, I was just telling my sister that while I do not enjoy pleasantries and chit-chat with people in an elevator, there's nothing I love more than a good conversation with people I'm interested in, people that I have a stake in shaping, and vice versa are the conversations I find most valuable. Do you think that a lot of people agree with Gina that there is this sort of shaping aspect of conversation?
Well, first of all, What Gina says, the name of my former boss, by the way, Gina, I wonder if it's she, although she's not in Wisconsin, so I doubt it. First of all, I think that the exchange of pleasantries and elevator talk and how's the weather are not really conversations, but there's nothing wrong with them. They are ways we have of saying that we're friendly, we're not going to try to steal their chickens, that we know social formalities in a good way, and there's nothing very serviceable. But I think that, yes and no. I think that all conversations are shaped. I think that you can look back on them if you remember the details and see that they went from point A to point B to point C in a kind of sensible associational way, just as in a therapy session when patients don't think that what they are saying is necessarily one thing linked to another. It turns out that they usually are. So I think that the conversations have similar sort of deep structures. But I think that they should, I mean, it's best when they come naturally. If you're actually trying consciously to shape a conversation, then it seems to me you lose some of the spontaneity of it. I think in retrospect is when you find out, you know what, we talked about five different things, but at the heart of it, all of it had to do with child raising in one way or another, and you realize there was a theme of that nature, or all of them have to do with the difficulty of working for a boss who doesn't bother to find out who you are, or whatever it is. There are often deep currents of unity in a conversation.
What about when you come away from a conversation changed? Someone has turned your viewpoint a little bit on its ear.
Well, that's unusual. And even if it's in a negative way, which I think for the most part we would say conversations that change us usually change us in a positive way. But in any way, I think those are very important and very unusual and rare instances. I can give you one example. In my own case, talking to a young woman at a writer's conference after a novelist read from his book, very good book, very good reading, and she turned around to me and she said, that was really great. And I said, yes, I'd never met her before. And she said, but don't you think it's sort of old-fashioned? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, you know, fiction novels about immigrants and immigration, she said, it's getting kind of old. And I said, well, explain. And she said, well, you know, my mother is from Sri Lanka, from Ceylon. My father is from Finland. And, you know, my grandparents were equally mixed. Most of my friends have very, very mixed ethnic backgrounds, and those who don't really care. So, you know, and we have this president who is half African-American and half African and half white. And she said, immigrant fiction just seems like almost old-fashioned now. We're all becoming so mixed. She said, it's not that it's not interesting, but it seems somewhat dated. That conversation changed my thinking in a very important way. I began to think of America in certain post-racial ways. I know we're not there yet. We may never get there, but it seemed to me, because I looked at this woman and she was, I can't tell you what color she was, it doesn't much matter. It was caramel, if anything. And I thought, my goodness, you know, this is a different world. I'm a certain age. I've got to start thinking in terms of these divisions possibly losing their power. Wouldn't that be nice? But also, what would we lose if we lost those identities? So it was a very important, not that anybody cares except me, but I've been thinking and actually writing about this ever since.
So it was just an impromptu conversation that had that much impact.
Yeah, I think, and you know, I was talking with somebody else recently. I'll give you another example. Someone else who has an adopted child, and we were talking about adoption. Both of my children are adopted, and she was saying that she had failed in some way about her kid and so on. And I said, well, the child is fine and there's nothing serious amiss, thank goodness. But there are issues, as there are with all children. And I said, you know, we don't know what the contribution between nature and nurture is. I mean, this difficulty, this challenge might have to do with his upbringing. It might also have to do with his biological background. And she actually hadn't thought of that. She thought whatever was going wrong or whatever was posing a difficulty was her fault. And so she sort of shook her head a little bit and said, oh, well, I hadn't thought of that possibility. So it doesn't mean can't be fixed, but, you know, think about it in wider terms. And I think maybe that's the key to those mind-changing moments, is that your mind is widened. It's mm-hmm. in certain mode, and suddenly someone turns the dial for you, and you say, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. And it's a new way of looking at the world, and it expands you. It's like travel. It's like the internal equivalent of traveling.
Let's take our first caller now. We have Alice with us from Sheboygan. Hi, Alice.
Hello. I'm very pleased to be on. I have five sisters, and we are all coming together for 2-3 days, and we all are exuberant extroverts, and we all talk over each other, and we all feel that we have many wonderful things to share. And what I'm trying to do is slow the conversation down. One time I even used a talking stick so that the person who had the floor could actually talk and nobody was talking over. And I guess my thought here is we want to value each other. We're going to be together in celebration. And I just, I have one sister that talks incessantly, and it's almost like we have to say, okay, excuse me, could you just hold that thought? Somebody else might want to say something. How do you deal with difficult people who just keep going and going and yet honor each other that we're going to be together? Any ideas?
Great question. Thanks, Alice. Daniel Menaker?
Well, I'm a gabber enough so that if you use the talking stick with me, I might break it in half and try to say that it was my turn. Or you could hit her over the head with the talking stick if she really insists on it. Sounds like you have a wonderful family. I envy and admire the value you have for each other, especially five sisters, I assume, grown up and still in good touch with each other. I don't see quite what's wrong with saying, hold on, excuse me, you know, with love and affection, you're talking, you know, we others have something to say. And instead of the talking stick, I have in the book a kind of, it's not really mathematical or scientific, as you'll be able to tell in 1 second, but I think 5 minutes is a good kind of, if you're having a party or if you're having a dinner with someone, if somebody talks more than 5 minutes, I mean, you could try that instead of the talking stick. You could sort of say, look, let's all talk as much as we want, but for, you know, for this amount of time, try not to go over this limit. We all have so much to say. And I found that that actually works. I also have found that 5 minutes is usually about as much as you want to hear from anybody, even someone you love, at one time. There's one exception. If someone's telling a good story and everybody wants to hear more and it's clear that it's sincere, then a person can talk as long as they want. That's why there's the Odyssey. I mean, you know, Homer was a great storyteller. But I'm now reaching very close to 5 minutes, so I better shut up myself.
I hope that helps you, Alice. And I take your point, but I also know we've all been stuck in scenarios where someone is telling a really long story, but it's incredibly dull, and you think they start the story, or maybe you've even heard the story before, and you know you have to sit through the entire thing. Is there any way to get out?
If there's a door, maybe. The courtesy, the requirements of courtesy make it very difficult. I remember being at a reading once, not quite the same, where the author had gone on reading for much longer than the allotted time, and it was dull anyway, and he was really into it, and he looked up and said to the audience, I'm not kidding, he said, this is pretty good. I can tell you want me to go on, which couldn't have been farther from the truth. There were people, you know, in comas practically. I don't know. I don't know. I know I've been in the situation where someone is rattling on. I think, you know, my rule about interruption, or my unrule about interruption, that you can actually interrupt and say, I don't know. I have a friend, if he says, you know, I had a hard time getting into town today because the trains were messed up. And you say, oh, well, what happened? He'll say to me, well, first of all, I have to tell you about how the railroad was established. He'll scroll back 100 years in order to tell me what his commuting problem was. But it's such an, it's so hilarious that he knows it himself, so we can joke about it. I don't know what you do. I think you have to grin and bear it.
Sounds like you're stuck.
Yeah, you're kind of, I mean, it does happen.
Let's take another phone call here from Dave in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, and interesting topic.
Thank you.
Your last comment about the fellow will go back in history. I've been told that people ask me the time, and I'll tell them how to build a watch. But
exactly.
But what I wanted to mention is for the past year or so, I've belonged to a group. They meet in Stevens Point. It's called Socrates Cafe, and perhaps you're familiar with that. There are a number of them around the country, and the normally there will be anywhere from 10 to 12, maybe 13, depending on the season. And we meet in a little coffee shop in Stevens Point, and people suggest topics for the day, and then we vote on the topic, and then we discuss it. And there are a number of ground rules, but the predominant ground rule is that we are required to listen. And I've discussed it with other members of the group at different times about how difficult it is sometimes to not start thinking about your response rather than listening. It's not a natural skill. It has to be learned, I believe. It's not instinctive. But it's amazing how we can take off on a topic and make a great big circle sometimes and end up back on topic. It's always interesting to see how far afield we can get, still get reined into the topic.
I think what you say about listening is crucially important. It's not necessarily an inborn trait. It does have to be, often have to be learned. It often is begun or encouraged in childhood circumstances. If your family listens to you, and if you listen to your family, and if you're taught to attend carefully to what's being said, and what you say about wanting, you know, thinking about what you're going to say next instead of actually listening to the person who's talking is a very common trait. And I have it myself. I think everybody does. And what you have to, I mean, all you can do in a situation like that is try to override it and remind yourself that, in fact, what you want to say may be influenced by what you are not listening to. And very often near the end of somebody else's presentation or part of the conversation, near the end of it, there will be something very important that you may miss if you're too, too concerned with what your response will be. I admire that meeting that you have. I wish more people would do it. It reminds me of one of the metaphors I have for good conversation, which is that they are like, if they are endangered, if they are threatened by emails and other electronic communications that don't have the same in-person rewards, we ought to regard conversation as something like national parks. There should be a conservationist movement, and you've done that in creating this group where you set aside a certain time and a certain place to have this conversation. It's almost like taking care of a natural resource, and I really admire it.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Dave. And we move on to Susanna in Madison. Hi, Susanna.
Hi. I also, I don't have conversations with a group like the previous caller, but I do have a conversation every Friday morning at 8 a.m. over coffee with a friend, and I enjoy it so much. I love good conversation. It makes me feel alive and engaged, and it makes me feel like an interesting person, and so that makes me feel good about myself. It just makes me feel alive. But I've been developing a theory that conversation involves chemistry, sort of the way falling in love does. Like, when you fall in love with, you're either in love with someone or you aren't. You can't, like, you know, make it happen. It's either there or it isn't. And for me, it seems like the same thing happens with conversation. Like, there's people who I always have an interesting conversation with, and then there's others where I just don't know where to start, and it's a big effort. It's just this big effort, and then I feel like a boring person, and I feel like a failure. And so I don't know whether I should just accept that that's the chemistry or whether I should try harder, or I don't know.
Well, I think you're being a little I think you're being a little hard on yourself, because obviously you have the capacity and the pleasure of being a good conversationalist. And sometimes, you know, this thing about clicking or not clicking, as in love, as you say, is just the truth. And that's why I think it's so important to be able to judge someone in their full selves, that is to say, in person, not necessarily by emails and so on. I mean, emails are easily manipulated and edited and so on. But if you meet someone and look at them and get the drift of them, and there are pheromones in the air, and there's body language, and there's facial expression, all those things will help you decide before any verbal exchange whether you're sort of drawn to the person. That's perfectly natural to be that way. And by the way, what you say about the chemistry of conversation is really important, because in fact that feeling that you have after a good one on Friday at 8 a.m. is chemically based. There's a hormone called the trust hormone called oxytocin, which is important in many other natural physical functions, such as breastfeeding and childbirth and so on. It is released during good conversation. It can even be released by a touch on the elbow or shoulder. So there is a chemical component in that sort of high and good feeling that you have. It is absolutely real and physical. So that's, I think, what you're experiencing, and you perceive it on a conscious level as a good time. And it's kind of addictive, and you want to go back next Friday at 8 a.m. Just from the sound of it, I wouldn't say that you could possibly be a dull person. If you feel like a dull person, I would say it's the other person's fault.
I know Susanna, actually. I'm pretty sure I know she's not a dull person. Anyway, thank you for that call, Susanna. And we need to take our next break right now with Daniel Menaker, author of A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. He's the author of 2 books of short stories and the novel The Treatment. His work has also appeared in The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate. And we have room for your phone call this hour. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can ask your conversation questions and share your own stories of great conversation. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you this Monday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk with Daniel Menaker, author of A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. And we have a couple of emails here. One is from Brian in Kenosha, who says that now that the guest knows what makes a good conversation, is he anxious around other people? Are people wondering if he's analyzing their every sentence? What do you think? Has that happened?
What a great question. And the answer is... Yes, it has, in a way I should have anticipated and stupidly didn't. It has resulted in some amount of social awkwardness where someone says, well, you better sparkle, Dan. Or they say, am I sparkling, Dan? But, you know, it very quickly, when you connect with somebody, that usually subsides pretty quickly. And also my wife... My wife just last night said, I said, well, I don't know why you're asking me that, or whatever it was. And she said, well, you wrote the book. You ought to know. I mean, you should know why I'm asking. Maybe I should have written the book. And so, yes, it has occasioned a few mainly funny little awkward situations, but it usually disappears very quickly.
And to be fair, everybody is dull sometimes, aren't they? Everyone has an off day, even the best, most sparkling conversationalist.
Well, absolutely. And I think that there are 2 subjects that bring that out in most of us. One is the weather, and which I do myself. It is a fail-safe, fallback topic, and there are reasons for that, in my opinion, which I won't bore you with. And the other is health. And I'm not talking about serious illnesses where people have a right and a necessity to discuss with their friends what's going on. And we have an obligation and out of love, a need to listen to when it does go on. I'm talking about routine, what I call organ recitals, where, you know, people sort of go on about this or that small chronic problem. That can be very dull. As well, and most of us do a little of that. Of course, you're quite right. we're not always Socrates.
Well, besides health, there are a couple of topics that you say are probably better left alone. One of these is politics, and the other is family, which is interesting. You think that these are touchy?
Well, obviously, both of them are crucial ingredients in conversation. So it's a little condensed to say that they shouldn't be talked about, because they will be talked about. What I think I'm advocating is, in the case of politics and in the case of religion, to go slowly to see whether there are sensitivities. If there's somebody you don't know, to see whether there are sensitivities, whether there are sore points that you might want to avoid in a casual conversation. But usually you can send out little reconnaissance people to talk about. It's like, as with swearing, you can sort of test the waters. You don't have to just jump in. And you can get to those topics eventually. The one that I would emphasize is not so much families, but children. Again, it should be donated information about children. It should not be solicited, in my opinion. With someone you don't know well, first of all, some families have difficulties having children if they're in their 20s or 30s. It may be a sensitive subject. Secondly, with people with grown children or adolescent children, there may be problems that you don't know about. And I would say you can open the subject, but gently, and let somebody tell you, if they want to, about how great their kids are or how they just had a baby or something like that. It's a little sensitive in this modern day and age, because they're, you know, kids do have trouble sometimes, and we have friends whose children have had rough moments. We're close enough so that we can talk about them. But with someone you don't know well, I'd say tread lightly.
And another phone call here. We've got Nancy joining us from Dubuque. Welcome, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'm a second career student in seminary, and I have a lot of interests outside of my faith.
Ooh. Hello?
I think we lost her.
Oh, that was promising to be interesting.
I know. I think we've got a little... I think she was heading toward maybe people being afraid to approach her as a seminary student. So maybe, I don't know, because of values or perceived values. Have you ever heard of that, people being maybe afraid to talk to religious people?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm sure that most people who are ministers and clergy of any kind do have a sort of automatic barrier of a slight nature between them and lay people who may feel that they... But, you know, first of all, it's their problem in a way. They chose to be in this calling, and they need to try to overcome it. But it's also the other person's problem as well. That is to say, the person may be a rigid, ideological person, in which case you may not want to speak to him or her anyway. But, you again, go gently. Go tread lightly. And you can find out whether they have interests in baseball as well as prayer. You can find out what kind of music they like besides, you know, liturgical music. They're human beings, and the chances are they probably suffer a little bit from that kind of isolation. So it's a challenge to both parties to find the common human nature.
Well, I hope that helps, Nancy. Sorry we missed your phone call there. And we'll
I also admire her for going back into seminary at what I assume is, let's say, not the age of 25. I think that's very cool.
And a good conversational point, too.
Absolutely.
Okay, how about Tom in Fond du Lac? You're on.
Hi.
Hi, Tom.
I have a problem. I have an individual who calls me, usually when he's stuck in traffic. And he is the most difficult individual to talk to. He doesn't hold up his end of the conversation. And this will go on for 15 or 20 minutes. And I do most of the talking simply because if I don't, there's these awkward long pauses. And at the end of the conversation, I'm just exhausted.
Wow. This is so familiar to me. I have a friend, a very good friend whom I like a lot, who doesn't hold up his end of the conversation either. Why we're friends, I'm not sure, except in other ways, he's a very interesting guy. And I remember a third friend saying to me, you know, when I have lunch with so-and-so, I want to tell him, would you please do some of the work here? And that's what it sounds like with you. I also have a friend who calls me when he walks his dog because he has nothing else to do. And I know exactly what you mean, how annoying it can be. I really like this person. I don't know. You know, you could excuse yourself because he can't see you, after all. And you could say, there's somebody at the door, or I'm about to go to sleep. No, you can't say that. You can always get out of a phone call by saying that you need to do something else. It's a white lie, but it might save you a lot of heartache. Or you can just... I know another person you go to lunch with and he doesn't talk. And I had a friend who said, I am not going to say a word when I go to lunch with him. And it lasted utter silence for 3.5 minutes.
That's
and
a long time.
And finally, the other person finally broke and asked a question. Why don't you ask your friend who's in the car stuck next to him? What does he look like? What kind of cars does he see most often? Get him to talk about the darn traffic jam if there's nothing else.
Huh. Those are good ideas. Not the most maybe interesting points, but at least you get the guy talking.
Well, they're desperate, but sometimes desperate measures are called for.
All right. Well, thank you, Tom. I hope that helps. An email from Marlene in Twin Lakes who says, a good conversation begins with being a good listener. Striking that balance is difficult, though, and I think that a lot of us know someone who doesn't seem to be listening the entire time. Is there a cure for that?
Sure. It may not, you know, sometimes it works, but sometimes it doesn't. I think just a gentle reminder, please listen to, I don't know if you heard what I said. I mean, it's really important to me. Please listen. You can interrupt the self-absorption of the other person by actually calling attention to it, saying, you know, I'd love to talk to you. You're fascinating, but I really need you to hear what I'm saying here. And it doesn't have to be quite that serious. It can be joking. But, you know, that's an obvious cure. But you know what? There are incurable cases. And if they're incurable, by definition, there's not much you can do about it. But I would advise and advocate to everybody that they train themselves in listening. And often, usually, when they're about to interrupt or say their own thing, to try to override, as if they were training, you know, themselves in a training school, say, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to listen to the end and hear what the person's saying.
So you don't think it's conversational death to point out that the other person isn't listening? That will what will come next will be 5 minutes of really awkward talk?
Well, if there's something about the other person that you like, if it's someone that you know and value for other reasons, I think maybe there are times when you have to. And we all know this from personal relationships where you have to take a chance and be honest and say, you know, I really like meeting you. There are so many interesting things about you. I don't think you listen. I don't know. I mean, you are taking a risk. It depends. It's a sort of cost-benefit analysis. Mm. If the cost of losing a friend is too great, then I suppose you have to make that judgment and say, I will take what I can get and not call attention to this. But I think there are medium ways that are not harsh to say. And I have a very good friend whom I have to tell to listen to me all the time. And by the way, she has to tell me to listen to her. So there's a joke almost about it.
Another call here. This is Ricardo with us from Madison. Hi, Ricardo.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I am, at least my wife tells me, that in conversations I can be very intense. And I'm headed towards a very important interview today, this afternoon, and I wonder if I could get a little bit of advice.
Well, two things. First of all, my wife tells me the same thing. I wonder if we have the same wife and don't know it. Secondly, I love intense people, and that's one of my problems. I really enjoy people who care about what they're saying and get involved in it and engaged in it. But you're quite right. It can be a difficulty, and it's one that I personally have. And I've tried to teach myself to lighten up a little bit, and particularly for the sake of an interview. I mean, you want to be interested and engaged, but you don't want to look like a madman, which is, I think, sometimes the way I have come off and under similar important circumstances. One thing I say in the book, and maybe it will be a help to you, I hope so, is that an important interview, like for a college admission or a job or an assignment or something like that, is often, if you take a longer view, not quite so important as we tend to think it is. It's I didn't get into the college I wanted to go to. In short, I got into another one. I met somebody, a professor, who changed my life. I wouldn't have ever had that person as a teacher if I'd gone where I thought I wanted to. Usually, all or nothing doesn't exist. Usually, it's, you know, this time or wait until next time. So, yeah, there are turning points, but if you can take a more philosophical approach, that your life is not, you know, that you're going to be the main architect of your life, whether you do or don't succeed in this particular interview, if you can step back and be a little Buddhist about it, I always find that helps.
Well, Daniel Menaker, we are out of time, but thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's been wonderful to talk with you.
My great pleasure. It's a great interview, and I admire the attention of your listeners in particular. They are really tuned in.
They are. Thank you so much for talking with all of us this morning. Daniel Menaker, author of A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation. His work has also appeared in The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate. Thank you to Erica Janik and Chrissy Pease for producing the hours this morning, and to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.